You're listening to Trot the Egging, hosted by John Hetherington, working with Widnes Rugby Union Football Club, sponsored by Boydells.
So, man, how have you been, mate?
Yeah, good, bud. Tracking on, as you know. Just Premiership and Champions Cup, it's not for the faint-hearted, bro. So just going, going, going.
Yeah, you've been non-stop, mate, in some big, big games lately, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. What's up on your side? Where are you based?
Yeah, so I'm up in Widnes, mate. So I'm between Manchester and Liverpool. So it's our closest team would be Sale.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. Do you have games in that?
Yeah, no, that goal the odd game, mate. It's a predominantly rugby league where I am.
Okay. Who's the closest rugby team?
What's that, sorry?
Who's the closest rugby league team?
So Widnes Vikings.
Okay.
Yeah, and then in Super League, from the top league, it'll probably be Warrington and St. Helens.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, yeah. Right, mate, so before we get stuck into your sporting story, because you're not predominantly like rugby-based, was you initially, mate? So where was home for you as a kid and who lived at home with you?
Yeah, so I was born in Zim, but I lived in Cape Town from like two years old. I had six siblings in total. I was the third oldest.
Was there a lot of competition at home, mate, between you?
I had four sisters. So believe it or not, that's probably tougher than having four brothers, because sisters are on you morning, noon and night. So like standards about everything. Why are you doing this? Don't do that. Don't you touch that. They're actually fucking more bossy than boys are. So probably a high level of vigilance and emotional intelligence training without realizing it.
So when did sport become a thing for you, Omar? And what sport really caught your attention at an early age?
Mate, from super young, four or five years old, I was playing rugby, but I played everything. Rugby, football, tennis. You couldn't drag me off a sporting pitch. Like literally, I think once when I was about eight or nine, I played so much sport. I think I did cricket, I did tennis all in the same day, and I went and did some swimming, and then I suddenly had such bad chest pain. The teacher said, "Well, we better call your mum." And she said, "What has he been doing all day?" She said, "Well, I think he did cricket, tennis, and whatever else at the time." It's like, was he supposed to do all? No, he told me he was supposed to do all. She said, "No, he wasn't supposed to do them all. He just wants to do them all." So I just loved sport. It was my outlet, you know, massively so.
So was it? When does it become competitive in South Africa, mate? When is it like a serious league and system, or when did you? Was you ever made to make a decision on what particular sport you've got to attack?
I think for me in South Africa, it's cricket or rugby, in the sense that, mate, very soon in the sort of pecking order and the hierarchy of life, it's like we were playing contact at like 6, 7 years old already. So 8, 9 years old, it's already like primary school, who's who in the primary school because you play rugby. And then it's who's who in high school because you play rugby. So, you know, in terms of physicality, intensity and stuff, like in South Africa, you've got massive boys. And we did contact virtually, I can remember doing it super young, probably six, seven years old. So, you know, massively competitive. So the drive to play rugby in SA is huge, you know, because you're one of the boys, you become sort of kind of, for lack of a better word, significant, you know, so one of the men you play, that's what you do.
Right. And I imagine probably because of how intense rugby is in South Africa, mate, you'd probably get away with a little bit at school if you played rugby.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the sort of unsaid thing, isn't it? It's like, yeah, the rugby guys are different gravy kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Times.
Right. And how was school for you, mate? What type of student was you?
Well, my mom wanted me to become a doctor. So she was very strict on me studying hard. I wouldn't say I got doctor grades, but I was good. I was solid. I'd get B's and C's, you know, often enough. I was getting A's and B's. But home life wasn't sustainable in terms of like studying really hard. We had a lot of stuff going on at home, but I still would get B's and C's. I'd get solid. So I was solid, yeah.
Yeah, and did you enjoy school, mate? Or were you more focused on the sport and you just happened to do well?
I think I'm the type of guy, I get done what needs to get done. So like when I'm told by my mom, study or you'll be nobody, then I tend to pay attention. So I wouldn't say I'm one of those guys that only sport or else. I was a good reader. I had a very nice mentor in my life. I'm around 8, 9 years old, who said reading's important, taught me to love reading, and I became quite a good reader, avid reader. So I think academics, I enjoyed the enlightenment, obviously I love sport more, but I wouldn't say I had that polar opposite where it was like, oh, read, oh, study. No, I didn't have that. I was like, oh, time to get into some books. I do it, you know? And then time to go to sport. Obviously, I was more excited about that, but it wasn't that polar opposite that you sometimes get, no.
So you're quite disciplined at a young age then, mate. So you knew when it was time to turn on study-wise and when it was time to turn on when it was game time, didn't you really, mate?
Yeah, I did. I
Yeah.
did. I was quite lucky like that because when I was at Worcester, I think I was 41, 42, I did my MBA going to classes. The MBA, lots of guys take sabbaticals for MBA because it's called the divorce course, Masters in Business Administration and Leadership. Very tough masters to get. And when I put my mind to doing it, because I just felt it's something I had to do to improve as a human being, man, I went to classes twice a week while coaching in the Premiership. People thought I was nuts, but I did it morning, noon, and night, morning, noon, and night. I'd off days, I'd study 12 hours. Non-stop, flat out. You know, when you, it's funny,
You
feel the urgency of why, when you know 100% why you do it, when you feel the gravity of like, flip, if I don't do this, I'm not going to be taken seriously. People are going to think, oh, you're this brutal collision-based defense coach. Good details, but how smart can you be? You know, I felt like, no, I set a marker down on how smart I am, you know, to show that I've got something else to be, you know?
Yeah, and are you good at chilling out the Walmart? Do you ever switch off, mate? Because you life in the role you're in, it's just 100 mile an hour, mate, isn't it? It's non-stop really up until probably the end of May.
Yeah, I would say I've got better at relaxing and making, you know, time for things that are outside of rugby. It's very difficult from a defensive standpoint because I'd say a lot of guys that I've been under head coaches wise always say that head coach and defense coach are probably the most stressful, and then maybe conditioning because people always
Yeah.
go, oh, are they fit enough? Oh, why are they leaking tries? Or with a head coach, or why is selection wrong? So you're always in the firing line. So it's very hard to switch off in the sense that you're always worried about, you know, spacing, alignment, shape, details, individual tackle tech, mindset. You know, it's not something you just go, oh, you know, we'll be fine versus Quinns. Oh, we'll just be fine versus. You never feel you're going to be fine. So you're always thinking about your one-on-ones. You think about your previews, your reviews. You just don't, it's not something you just go, oh, I'm just going to let go. But as I've got older, I've had to go, okay, listen, I've done as much as I can do. My off day, I have to prioritize a bit of wellness, you know, training, sauna, stretching, hydration, because you can go down a wrong road not looking after yourself because it is high stress, obviously.
Right. So, how was the standard of rugby at school, and when did club sport become a thing, or was it predominantly school?
Now, I did play for my club as well. I played for school and club. So, what do you mean? When did it become competitive?
So, no, was which would take priority, and which was more standard wise, which tested you more?
So I didn't go to good schools, to be honest, but we always played very good schools. You know that story. So like
Yeah.
our A team played like Paul Gym, Paul Roos, which are killer schools, some of the best in the world. Then you play their B's and C teams, and you take pastings. I mean, these guys are some kids at 16 and 18 are 100 kilograms, 110 kilograms, monsters, 6 foot 2. So the standard of rugby was high, but our school standards, because I couldn't afford to go to expensive school. You know, I would always go to Craven Week trials because I was the best player in my team, but I wasn't the best player in the country. You know what I'm trying to say? Very, very, very tough rugby, I'd say. Really trench warfare because, you know, when you play Stellenberg and you play Paul Boys, who are monsters with, you know, their B team, C team against your A team, you still take pastings. You know, you learn the hard way. But we had some good times too. And in terms of club was a good level. At times you played some like serious clubs, but it was really rough at club level. You know, you're going to some rough areas, you play rough rugby, big fights, super physical, hard grounds. Club rugby is not, it wasn't a joke. You know, sometimes when you're covering your own medical bills as well, mate, it was tough.
Yeah, but it was. So we're going to touch on a little bit where the attritional leagues you've been involved with as an adult, mate, in the defense and defensive coach staff wise. But in South Africa, it is attritional, isn't it? Not only can you bash up, you play as well, don't you? Where French rugby's getting that way, but it's not always been that way, mate, has it? So is that something you think you've managed to take into your coaching career, what you've experienced as a youngster?
Yeah, I think because I was small, I had to find ways to play differently, especially from a defensive standpoint. So I did martial arts, which made me functionally quite tough in contact, especially breakdowns, tackles, and stuff like that. So I could handle myself one-on-one. But what I quickly had to realize is I couldn't, like a guy who looks like your size, I mean, you look big on camera, I don't know how big you really are, but
I'll take that.
You get these big lug props, 120 Ks. I'm talking a club or school, who are asking for the ball. And like, if you just wait for them to come, you are going to get hurt. There's no question about it. So I would do things like blindside guys as they catch the ball. I rip the ball out their hands, or they catch it and I just grapple them and then hold them up until they fell because they didn't have momentum. And I learned quite quickly, like, oh, you could be quite smart about this. Because as a wrestler, grappler, boxer, I realized obviously being highly technical and fit, if you were super technical, you could beat bigger guys because being smart and sharp, it does count for something. And I started to realize, well, it's not that different in rugby. So I definitely transferred that across to my guys who are highly athletic, not as big as a pro. And I always point out to them, what do you think your super strength is? And I go, well, I'm pretty bright. I learn quickly and I'm quick. So yeah, quick's a weapon because you look at Chez and Colby and these guys, mate, you just blink to get the ball, you jammed, blindsided turnover. So yes, there was commonalities, me learning those hard lessons, going, I am a smaller dude. What do small guys endure? They endure that. And then there's a way to get around it.
Right. So when did the MMA come around, mate, and why did it come around?
So MMA was because I got really badly bullied when I was young because of my name and sort of something around my perceived culture. So my name, Omar, in South Africa's got a lot of jokes that surround it. So it's spelt OMA and OUMA in a certain circles in South Africa. So one's a type of special biscuit that's really famous. So and it's called grandma's biscuits, but Omar means grandma. So it's, oh, Omar, are you a biscuit? There's Omar washing powder, which is grandma's washing powder, very famous back home. Oh, are you a washing powder? Why you got a stupid name? And then when they find out it's actually an Arabic name or Lebanese name, then they used to go like, oh, you don't look like you're supposed to be colored. Are you cut like, and then they bring in a race thing. And what does your name represent? Are you Muslim? Why Omar? And like, I used to just get battered, battered. My brother's name was Michael. He never endured a single problem. You know what I mean? I had to explain I'm Lebanese by heritage, blah, blah, blah. And then like, I got into a lot of trouble. Guys would just go, that's a stupid name. Plock. Or what? I could go, there's nothing wrong with my name. Just fucking leave me alone. Plock. And they just pick on you, wouldn't they? And then so I eventually learned to defend myself. I did boxing, I did kung fu, I did judo, all that stuff. But nothing felt like I could, like boxing was really good, but nothing felt like I could handle myself when I was getting roughed up proper by big dudes. So I started wrestling and then I saw Brazilian jiu-jitsu many years ago. That's like fucking cheap, but like what, 30 years ago, whatever it was. And I saw it in a magazine that you could buy at a bookstore. And I saw these intricate moves and how you can grapple a bigger guy and arm lock him and triangle him and choke him, which is very common these days. And man, I just got into it. One day I met a guy who was training in it. He was fighting in Japan, came to Cape Town, was doing a seminar. I asked him for one-on-one classes and I ended up training with him every day for 2 years. And MMA was, I've just found that's the answer. I can bang, I can grapple, I can clinch, I can put a guy down, I can handle a guy if I'm on my back. And it just became the way to keep myself safe. And mate, it just did wonders for my rugby, did wonders for everything I'd played, actually. It's a fucking incredible sport that.
No, and obviously I mentioned to you like when I've messaged you, I remember before I realized who you was, I seen your content and some of the stuff. I was like, I've not seen this before, and I can understand now like why you were doing movements you were doing, and you were explosive, and that all comes from the combined sports, doesn't it? And MMA.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I just try to be a hybrid. I just try to be thinking out the box, think out the box.
Yeah. And that's what some of the best people are, mate. Outside the box thinkers, aren't they? Your everyday book doesn't cover that type of thing, like you said. It's like what might work for the beast doesn't work for Cheslin, does it? And vice versa. So, right. So position wise, Omar, where was you playing, and what part of rugby did you feel really you enjoyed most? Was it in the ruck area and stuff due to what you're learning?
Yeah, so they put me at hooker because I
Yeah.
was strong for my size. I was stocky, but I didn't like it. I just didn't. And at that time, scrums were very uncontrolled. A lot of schoolboys were breaking in their necks. My mom didn't like it. She was like, mate, you got to get out of there. And I was fine at it. But then they put me to flank, up at blindside and open side. And that was where I started to come into my own because I was really quick, honestly. I was rapid and I was tough. So that worked out well. And then I got lured to the backs where I played at times. 12 or 13, but mostly 12. And then it was like, I like to tackle, I could make a difference, and I played with the ball. And I finished playing like that. But I did miss the forwards. But the problem was, I just stayed kind of like, 5'7", 80 Ks. I wasn't going to be a force to be reckoned with as a flank. Whereas as a 12, I could run, jam out of the line. I could carry nicely. I was hard to take down because I was evasive. So it suited
Yeah.
me. My longevity to play a little bit more was like 12.
Yeah. And as a youngster, mate, how did you view defense?
How did I?
So as a youngster, how did you look and view defense? Was it,
I loved it. I always did.
yeah, and
It's
broke
always.
it down like you do now, yeah.
I always liked it. It's just bizarre. So my grandmother lives in Australia, and my cousins play for Randwick, and I used to always go visit her for 2, 3 months at a time to get a break from home. And my cousins always, we used to like go watch their games or go train at their trainings, or they had like an informal six downs game at a park. My cousins would always talk up on defense and say like, mark up who you got, who's in your channel, da da. And I just loved it. I was like, oh, that's cool. They got the vibe around defense, like point, who you got, who's on the short, what's the switch. And I just went, oh, I liked it. And I took that off them. This guy that on a pitch, I just talk about what was unfolding. Valuable information, was energetic, spoke about the plays. And people used to say, well, don't stop talking. I love it. Don't stop talking. I love it. And then I was like, oh, this kind of works. And it's something I brought into my defense, you know, valuable information while being energetic is massive. And so, yeah, that's one of the things that I really pride myself on. Good comms, valuable comms.
I'll be honest with you, I've not played to the levels you've coached at and probably played at, but I found if one person's willing to do that type of talking, as much as other people might be on their ass and blowing, they'll still respond to that with an action rather than a vocal, won't they?
Yeah. That's the truth. Now, listen, and I mean, we always used to say, like, even if you can't answer me, just get there. So I'll direct you, just get there, you know, and it worked. It did work to a degree.
So when they come to leaving school, mate, what was your plan and what was you looking to do?
Mate, it was a difficult one because in the last sort of 2 years of my high school, a lot was going on at home. My parents had a tumultuous time. And my marks probably went down at that stage. I started getting C's mostly, not B's and C's, and not no A's. So, you know, it was a bit tough. My mom wanted me to go to uni to be a doctor. I didn't qualify. So I actually went and did another year where you got a chance at certain subjects to redo to get A's, which I ended up getting B's. But I ended up just being a hardworking. I worked. You know, I did some extra studies to get those marks up, and I worked. I worked at waitering jobs. I had sometimes day shift, night shift in different places, and I had waitering jobs. I worked
And
my
then
ass.
when did,
I bought my own car from obviously working my ass off.
yeah.
I was given nothing. I had nothing. So, you know, everything I had to do.
Yeah, and probably without knowing it, mate, your character through school, through home life, through the bit of bullying, the MMA, the rugby is all building resilience and desire and seriousness. And your discipline from a kid has been probably immaculate due to all the circumstances helping mold what you become. So, what was the ultimate ambition once the jobs were coming in? Where did you see yourself going? Was rugby going to be where you went to?
I was still playing sport nonstop. You know what's funny? I always felt a connection to sport in a magical way, like Any Given Sunday, Friday Night Lights, those type of sport movies really inspired me. And every time I watch them, I'd be like, imagine being like either a coach or playing that rock and roll all in situation where, you know, it's all about performance, dying with your brothers, etc. And I always felt it while doing other things. Like when I played sport, I felt like I was living it, you know, but obviously I wasn't into pro sport yet. And then I was like an entrepreneur, I was a marketing manager. I was finding my feet because I missed the doctor thing. I got thrown off, and my mom was the type of person that she showed that disdain, unfortunately, for a long time. Like, oh, unless you're a doctor, you're nobody. But I just couldn't get in the doctor wagon. I mean, we talk about people get A pluses. There's hundreds of them that get in on A pluses. You know what I mean? So yeah, I just worked hard, became an entrepreneur, tried a couple of things, was a marketing manager. The whole time though, sport was part of me. I was training flat out like I was a pro. I trained MMA, rugby like I was a pro. I'd play rugby matches, get ready for fights in the same week. Like, yeah, it's crazy. And
Yeah.
it was always head. It's weird. It's like destiny comes together, doesn't it? Because the first break I got, which I'm sure we'll talk about now, but just because it is linked to this, was I was training for MMA fight. I was cutting weight for the first time in my life. I hadn't done that before. There was a center called the Sports Science Center of Cape Town, which was only pros. Stormers trained there, Olympic people trained there, and you'd pay a fortune for a conditioning guy or head of performance to coach you. And I was paying back then, but I don't even lie to you, an hour was like £60,
Yeah.
like in 1999, something like that, like ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so I was training there for fights for a long, long time. But then my conditioning guy moved on. He became the head conditioning guy of a Proteus cricket. So he was really high level. And then he said, listen, I'm going to put you on to somebody else. And that was around 2004, 2005. 2006, I'm training for a fight. And this guy says to me, listen, Holmes, you fucking move like an animal. You're so quick. You're so strong for your size. It's ridiculous. When you play rugby, is there a regime you use in your games for this stuff? I said, yeah, there's a regime I use. He says, could you coach guys to do what you do? I said, yeah, I think so. I've got some moves. He goes, with Springbok Sevens are struggling. We're last in the league in every single physicality stat. We're going nowhere. We can't beat Fiji, can't beat Samoa, can't beat New Zealand. They're looking to hire somebody who's going to bring these qualities you already have. And they're interviewing karate guys and defense coaches, but it's not working out. Will you meet Paul True? I said, sure, I will. So I met him. I did a demo for 5 minutes, and he literally said, mate, you're my guy. Let's get you in there. And from there, all that stuff you saw, I mean, guys had never even dreamed of crossbreeding MMA drills with jiu-jitsu, with rugby league. Like, I mixed it all in one. And we had great success. I mean, we just flew up the physicality stats, the island teams, we could handle them physically front on, just was a different ball game. And from there, I felt like, mate, if I keep being studious now, I'm going to make it. And then I got a call from Russell Rasmussen, a similar guy, saying, look, yeah, we drift on defense, we don't bang, we go and go square like you like. Talk me through what you do that's so different. And he gave me the job sort of pretty in a similar way. So that, coming back to your destiny question, sport just kept following me. I'd go marketing manager, I'd go entrepreneur, sport followed me. And because I stayed in immaculate shape, trained like a pro, nutrition like a pro, paid for massage, chiro, exactly like I'm almost fantasized. I was completely full pro, which I was without a contract. And I was in the right condition at the right time. Every time it came to show what I could do, I was actually in shape to do it, which helped a lot, actually.
Yeah, that's mentality that the Walmart, isn't it? It's like just being ready for that slight opening that you grasp with both hands. So how different was it your headspace from being ready to fight to being ready to play rugby? How did you manage them different emotions?
I felt rugby was easy in that sense compared, like, again, like I'm saying, I'm not the giftest, biggest guy. And I probably, because I love fighting so much, I maybe didn't concentrate on rugby the right way. If I had a mentor, we'd say, listen, choose one now. You can go a bit further, focus on just this one. Maybe that would have helped. But focusing on rugby, so I think my combat mindset of, like, they say the eye of the tiger is someone who doesn't flinch. Basically, when you learn combat sports, you flinch in the beginning. But after learning how to fight, you don't flinch because you've got that recoil, you've got that confidence, you know what's coming, and you know how to combat that. So you get that eye of the tiger where you don't blink, where the guy doesn't know how to fight, blinks. And that took into my rugby because the guy would run at me, and however I cut him off, I'd be like, yeah, it's me and you. And I loved it. Then there was a squash in the ruck and a bit of a tussle in the ruck, throw me over, throw you over. And I just embraced that. And I could thank MMA for that. And I could probably thank rugby for the body hardness it gives you. Because when I was wrestling and grappling, guys found me like body hard and difficult to contend with at times. So they both mixed together nicely. And I enjoyed the game between the mindsets because I felt rugby easier because I didn't think guys were pure killers in rugby when it came to a street fight. You know what I'm trying to say? As in really rough in a ruck, not just running because you're bigger than me. I'm talking about getting to each other over and over. So it was interesting.
So rugby was probably a bit more structured. Sorry to interrupt you, wasn't it? Where the MMA is like off the cuff, isn't it? You sort of fight what you see.
Wow. And listen, you learned like setups and all that, which made you, the good fighters have good setups. But I think it gave you that thing of like, what's going to happen to me on a pitch? What are you going to do to me? What are you going to tackle me? So, oh, that's fine. That's fine. This other guy just punched my head in, held me down, and elbowed me in the face, and then tried to stomp on me. That's something to worry about, I'd say. My training partners at the time, I had some international training partners, mate, they kicked the shit out of me, like literally the daylights out of me. So for me, rugby was okay. But I think the choice, the thing of to do both, I love both a lot. Maybe it wasn't prudent looking back now. Well, maybe it was because I end up in where I am. But
Because of where you are, yeah.
yeah, but maybe someone else would have said, mate, why don't you choose one and see what you do? So I didn't.
Right. No, I quite like that you didn't know, because it's obviously like we just mentioned then, it's why you are who you are and where you are, just through pure dedication and hard work. So what was the sevens like? Is the travel difficult, mate? Is the logistics difficult, or is a coach just a coach regardless?
So I didn't always travel because I'd go on some tours and some tours I stayed behind. One of my key jobs was getting the next crop of guys who would be in rotation to be tough, like, because running fit and collision fit are not the same thing. So we rotate, like we rotate. I wouldn't always travel. I would stay behind. We used to call them the tadpoles. The paddock. There was a nickname was the paddockies, the tadpoles. I used to take the tadpoles. and make sure they're ready to go again, go, go, and go. So I was often left behind to create a new crop of intensity and physicality with those lads and swap them in. And then the old bucks who needed a break and came back in, when they were rest and recovered, we topped them up. And that was my job, was to make defensively and collision-wise that a sick work rate, that could handle themselves, and they're always ready to go. So it was quite a different designation, but it was really interesting. But Sevens is very full on. The training's very tough, as you know, and it's different, yeah.
Do you know, once you've helped the incline go that way rather than declining in the seven circuit, do you see more blokes wanting to play, putting their hand up to play because you've changed the culture and the playing style?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in terms of making them more capable to do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What you see is like some players who are like a shadow of themselves because they've got the skills, but they don't have the physicality and the intensity to maintain. Once they get that edge, they're just different players.
And how is it at that? So really, because you've played 15s up to that point, I think you're all mad. So how was it adapting, mate? How did you find that?
Well, I played a lot of six downs rugby and I played sevens at times because in the preseason warm-ups to at school, you'd always play sevens tournaments. So I understood what it was about. And I kind of like the evasion one-on-one. It's me versus you because it's me to stop you one-on-one. But really, you have to contest breakdowns. You have to be smart about decisions about shutting and waiting. So I could kind of understood that from my sort of six down touch days and sevens sort of preseason games. But yeah, it was a bit of an adaptation. Of course, it would have been. But it wasn't hard to catch on, I don't think. It caught on pretty quickly. I had some good guys around helping me learn. So it was fine.
I know it, in the full 15 aside call, mate, it's still very much patience and picking your time, but especially at sevens, it's about picking the right time, isn't it, to compete, to counter, to so it yeah, it's I imagine for players. And how was it difficult to get a buy-in, mate, or was buy-in always been pretty good for you?
Buy-in's been good. You know what happens though? So you give them the why, big picture. You know, this is why, this is how it's going to benefit you. Let's give it a go. You know, they get results from it virtually instantaneously. So then they believe. And it's hard for them to believe in the beginning, but they give it a go because I try and be as compelling and as, you know, detailed as possible. In the first 2 weeks, most guys are like, holy hell, what is this? This is so tough. And then I explained to him, it's because you've never used your body multidirectionally. You've never been strong pound for pound. You know, you've never had the power endurance to do it repetitively in a row until it's blood and guts. And so they buy that and they go, that's pretty true about me. And they go, well, just give it a go for 2 weeks and see how you go. The next time they're 3 weeks in, the version one of themselves will never come close to that version two and three of themselves. They know it. By the time they hit a warm-up game, we always get traction is warm-up games where they're just like, holy hell, wow. I didn't know 5 weeks of that stuff was going to make me do this because they're just colliding with guys. They're brave as hell. They're just almost autopilot, getting stuck in blood, guts, and glory, getting up, doing it again, reload, reform, defend, defend. And they're like, oh, wow, something's gone on here. It's working. And then it's done. Then it's sold, you know? But you've got the big picture details and the why has to be like, whoa, that's compelling. Tell me more. Yeah, your nervous system does this. Your body does that. You react like this. That's why we're going to train you like this. And they pretty much go, well, you've thought that through. So I'll try. And then, few weeks later, they go, oh, I really feel quite strong and different. And then, oh, 5 weeks later, I feel very explosive. And then, thank God, it works.
Well, because I imagine a lot of them are just, without being rude to anybody, even when you've come over here in France and stuff, from a young age, you're only taught certain techniques, aren't you, Omar? And it's probably quite difficult to, you mentioned then, come away from to try something new, because not everybody's a creature of change, are they? They're
No.
quite nice into the routines and habits and like what they like and know
Yeah,
what they know.
exactly. That's normal. I agree with
So
you.
when Rassie comes round then, mate, why move if everything's going okay? Why go back to the 15-a-side game and have a go again?
I think for many reasons. Number one is Super Rugby was massive at the time. Super 14 is colossal. Rassie was a guy that coached in the Currie Cup and won it with the Free State Cheetahs, which is an underdog team at the time. He was known as a guru, next level guru in the game. I wanted to be back in 15s. Obviously, it's financially more viable, more scope in the game, etc. And so he had heard about what I was doing and he asked to see me. And I actually took two Springbok Sevens players. One was a captain, Mpho Mbuyozo and Marius Schoeman. Those two guys demoed my stuff for me, which Rassie quite enjoyed. But We came into an office, Jacques Nienaber, who Jacques Nienaber is. He's an assistant and coach, and he was Springbok head coach now. He's a defense coach, but he was there on the left. Rusty was on the right. Rusty turned the chair around and said, "All right, Ninja, talk me through. Give me your pitch. What's the pitch?" And I explained to him my pitch, which is about the nervous system, and rugby players are all stiff and don't have that multi-directional movement and functional explosiveness and their techniques were wanting in combat situations, contact situations. It was like, "Okay, cool. Let's go outside. Put your money where your mouth is." Comes outside. There's the Springbok Sevens guys. It was like quite pleasantly surprised. "Oh, you're going to do the demo. That's impressive." And we demoed for 5, 10 minutes, mate. He said, "Let's get inside and talk in my office." He said, "What's your expectations?" We had a chat about it. Boom, Bob's your uncle. Got in that quick.
And how are you in the new environment?
How am I?
Yeah.
I think pretty good. Obviously, like anything, you're not going to be perfect. You grow and learn as you go. But I think I fitted in well. I did my job like I was supposed to. I think when you're young and you're impetuous, sometimes you need to be told to slow down. But I'm always respectful of the places I come into, humble myself under the system and the default culture. Rusty ran a very good show. I was very blessed to learn under him. I learned some amazing things under Rusty. The 3 years there was my internship into how to be a proper pro, like another level pro. So super blessed. Always be grateful to him for that.
And when you're around that level of talent and ability, mate, is it just sometimes just the fine margins? Because I've no doubt you've got a few people coming through that you need to change a fair bit, whether it's technique, whether it's ability, whether it's just wanting to put their head in a place they probably normally wouldn't. So what were the differences that you noticed?
From place to place or just Stormers?
Used to players.
Well, let's put it this way. Each team and each group of players has something in common when they're ailing. So it doesn't matter if it's like Sharks in South Africa used to have a lot of Springboks and lost their way and just couldn't perform on defense or physically or intensely as they wanted, or it was Worcester trying to stay up in the Premiership. There's always, when a team ails, there's always a common thing. It's normally something to do with the ability to have high work rate with high details and be physical, abrasive, and consistent. And when you could put those things into play, you give confidence in your physical ability. You've got high level technical details, and you can do it repeatedly. You create a default culture of excellence, of run, gun, get it done at all costs. I'm on the line. I'm valuable information. I'm being energetic. I'm connecting with people. I'm reading plays. I'm brutal. I can do it again and again. That is the best of the best. But when you're trying to resuscitate teams that just lost their way, it always looks the opposite. It looks low work rate, low involvement, the involvements are low quality involvements and so on. And it's almost the same template to pull it back. You know what I mean? It's like great why, good big picture understanding into micro details. And then the physicality, work rate, and system go hand in glove. Not like I'm super physical, but I don't understand anything. Or I'm super technical, but I can't be physical. You almost see the same picture that needs to come together every time. Obviously, in the great teams that just need an edge, you are doing a little bit less of that. But I'd say if a team vaguely has lost its place a bit, then that's what happens.
Because whether people will agree or not, I'd say most elite people will. Defense wins games.
It does absolutely.
Basically, mate, doesn't it? It's a fact. Defense will win you games.
It does. Look, in the modern era, obviously attacks become a real problem. Like this is becoming a golden era of attack. People don't believe me. Running exit, running kickoffs, quick taps all over the place, organized taps in the 22. Like attack has just got a myriad of tools. All the playmakers in the teams, sorry, the playmakers in the team are not the obvious, the props, the locks. The loose forwards, or carrying the ball in 2 hands, showing, going, tipping on at the right time. Like it's got, heading into a golden era of really getting on top of defense. Like we have to be smart about what we're doing next to contain these guys.
So, and then how was your time at the Stormers, mate? Something you've really enjoyed, you touched on. So talk to us a little bit about how it went at the Stormers.
Well, there was a massive, it was quite interesting because my job was to bring physicality, go square, be north, double hits, defensive breakdown, intensity in tandem with Jacques' defensive system. And obviously being involved there was incredible because Rusty every single day would make the Stormers headquarters like a laboratory. We'd go 100 clips about how to double hit, single hit. If I place the ball like this, when I carry, if I take a step and go out versus a step and go in. and all the permutations, and you look at the stats and the facts, like crazy scientist about rugby. So that time was incredible for me to see that somebody took that as seriously as I took my MMA training. And I would coach guys in MMA as well. So when you coach individual athletes, you pay a lot of attention to like head movement, chin movement, where you put your hands, timing, you know, how you warm up properly, like a specific warm up for a specific boxing session into a, you know, ground and pound session to jiu-jitsu session was very meticulous in the singular purpose of a guy. But Rusty took that type of detail to a team. Went, okay, what does the team need? What do the mini units need? What does this individual need? And mate, he was meticulous in finding best practice all the time, which was something I picked up straight away. He's in at the office super early, leaves super late, but not just for the sake of it. Rewatching training, rewatching games, taking the best games of the weekend, going like, what was in common with the winners? What was in common with the losers? He got me to think about things to the core of the core of the core without telling me to think about things like that. He was just doing it. So you just go, wow, that's how to think. And I think I did enjoy that because MMA is very technical. People don't realize MMA is very technical to punch, kick, knee, clinch, takedown, ground up, scramble. Like there's a lot that goes into MMA. It's a very layered game. I enjoyed that chess match that is MMA, but he showed me the chess match of rugby by just going underneath him. So I was really blessed. It was a good time. There were a lot of good Springboks there, Jean de Villiers, Schalk Burger, you know, top guys there at the time. It was a good apprenticeship, you know, very good apprenticeship. And even as an experiment, we coached the Currie Cup under 20 team, which was a lot of the Bulls, Storm, Bulls, Western Province, and so on. All the superstars coming through at that time, a high level. Rusty and I actually coached them in the Currie Cup under 20s because we hadn't won it for a long time. We actually won it. And that year was quite fun to see him do it like he does it with a bit of a twist with the Young Bucks. You know, all the Young Bucks who ended up becoming like Springboks and stuff. No, great coach. It was an incredible period. It set the tone for me for a lot of things.
Imagine this is throughout your career, but while we're talking now, mate, I'll mention it. But do you get a big kick out of seeing a development in a person come to fruition, whether it is winning a trophy or just becoming a better player than they was when you met them? It must be a nice feeling that.
It's a beautiful feeling. And, you know, obviously there's the whole vilification of like collisions now because of head contact. But you've got to remember back in the day to get a guy to defend the line with honor and stop people legitimately was tough to do. People weren't doing it. Most people would give meters away, you know, and you had to find good, safe ways to make them confident to do that. And when you turn a guy around who was just giving meters and, you know, was like, oh, well, I won't put my body on the line. I'll give him 3, 4 meters, five in five different tackles that leads to a try. And as long as I carry well, I suppose I don't care about tackling. You take that guy and turn him around into a good tackler, into a good defender, someone who cares about the team and actually helps you win games. Mate, it's the best feeling. And when you take a guy that could be great at defense and you actually put the time in and he becomes great on D, not just good, great, it's the most beautiful feeling. Genuine, it's a great feeling.
I can imagine, mate. So, nothing really changed regarding the standards then between like the Super Rugby and the Currie Cup. Did you
No,
not notice?
it was very good. You had Springboks playing in the Currie Cup. You had internationals playing in, you know, Kiwis and Aussies playing in the Super Rugby. Like you had the best of the best all the time. It was really amazing, honestly.
Mate. So, when Western Province come round, what was the talk with it? So was it a big decision to go and do it, or was it nice and easy?
Well, Western Province and Stormers are on the same place. It's the same job.
Yeah.
So you go from Super Rugby to Currie Cup. It's just it's kind of like just trans it's like Champions Cup and Premiership. That's kind of like Super Rugby was like the Champions Cup and Currie Cup was the Premiership. Do you want me to go upstairs? They're going upstairs. They're gonna go show. So my kids are just home. So it was good. I mean, we actually played the British and Irish Lions and went in a very close game with Western Province. I was there at the time. And so it was good. It was different vibes because Super Rugby, you travel all over the world, not all over the world, Southern Hemisphere travel. And the Currie Cup was just local, but it was high standard.
So, sorry, I probably didn't word that properly. Would you have had maybe like fringe squad players coming up with like maybe junior Springboks in that Currie Cup? Was that how it'd be?
Yeah, probably not as how it is today in most teams where you give super young guys a go all the time. Probably less so, but yes, that was the Currie Cup under 20s was like a breeding ground, and so was normal Currie Cup was a breeding ground as well, you know.
So how did the Italy move come round? And what was the talk around that?
The Italy move was quite crazy because I was giving a talk at Captain's Run, or I think we were playing the Bulls, I can't remember. But Nick Mallett was around and he heard me chat. And he said to somebody, "Oh, this is an interesting little guy, little dude. Who is this little dude?" And someone said, "No, this is what he does." He's like, "That's quite fascinating. Give me his number. I want to have a cup of coffee." Ask him, no. So they said, "Ask him if I can have a cup of coffee with him." John Dobson. It was actually John Dobson. And who's good mates with him, and he's obviously the, he's been the coach of Stormers for years and years. I know John from the start when he started it. You know, he started after me, and he met him for a cup of coffee. He said, "Listen, I'm Nick Mallett." I said, "Of course I know you are. You won the most tests in the history of Test rugby, 17 in a row, 18 in a row at that time." And he said, "Look, I've got a problem. My guys can't maintain the intensity on defense. We've got must wins tests coming up, a bunch of tests, and if I lose all of them, I'll probably lose my job. Do you think you can help?" I said, "I need to see the footage." He said, "Can I send you the footage?" I said, "Send the footage." Send me the footage. I said, "It can work. Send me the schedule." He sent me the schedule, said we'd have 10 days with the boys in a camp where I could have every day for defense if I needed. I said, "Okay, that's all right." That year, it was 2010. I'd looked at some stuff for him, but I hadn't gone across. But we had Currie Cup finals in with the Stormers. With South Western Province, we were in Durban. We had under 19s, under 20s, and seniors all in Currie Cup finals. First them, three games in a row. That night, I was flying straight to Italy to help Nick, just as a consultant. 10 days, I arrived. Actually, the first day I arrived, I said, "Am I taking a session today?" He goes, "No." Half an hour later, he goes, "Yo, get your kit bag. I want you to take a session in the next 40 minutes." I think it was. So we trained 10 days of D, basically, obviously with breaks, but we put like a lot of time into D, like work rate collisions, line out mapping, scrum mapping. And it's so weird. Like that prep at Stormers was like perfect. Like I couldn't be more ready to go, okay, I'm gonna run the show myself now in that sense. And mate, like we fucking nearly beat Australia. We shocked them. We beat Fiji and Argentina. And he came to me and said, "Mate, I want to offer you a full-time job." Like, wow, like I'm so happy, you know, with what you've done. And then that was all she wrote. Then I got stuck in with Nick, did a senior World Cup, did two Six Nations. Then he left and I stayed with Jacques Brunel one more year, but we beat France for the first time in history. And we won two games in the Six Nations for only the second time. And we did well. But after Nick left, Jacques Brunel was a good coach, a decent coach, but it was, you know, it was time for me to go after I hit the third year, I reckon it was time to go. And I got offered this thing in Super Rugby anyway. So, yeah.
Happy days, that ain't it, me. So, what's how are them big tournaments to be involved in as a coach, mate? Is it big excitement and what an opportunity?
Mate, Six Nations is something else, mate. It's hard to imagine, dude. It is colossal. Like, I was so shocked. Well, even test matches. Okay, so the first test matches were amazing. Like, you've got 80,000 people, you know, at Stadio Olimpico and stuff like that. You can't even imagine it because you go, Italy, they can play all right from time to time. But I mean, what the hell, mate? You get there, it's rammed. Six Nations against Scotland away. You know, you've got the bagpipes, you've got the tunnel of people, everyone greeting you, coming in, and you're like, what the heck? Six Nations is incredible. Okay. Test rugby is incredible. And then we did the Six Nations, sorry, we did the World Cup in New Zealand. We were based there for weeks and weeks and weeks. And mate, it came down to a game to beat Ireland to go to the quarterfinals. And that was in Dunedin. And well, that was one of those where all the Irish came out, you had no chance. The Forsyth Barr Stadium, that one that's enclosed in Dunedin, was just green everywhere. We felt like we were in Ireland, maybe we could speak. But some incredible memories. Like Test rugby is incredible. It's actually hard to understand. It's incredible. And everyone wants to die for the cause. You know, you don't have to speak twice.
Right, so that really probably semi-answered what I was going to say, but is it difficult only being involved with a team for a short period of time rather than throughout a full playing season?
Yeah, obviously it's more difficult, but it's different. It's like it can be very, very rewarding and engaging. Like, for example, we'd set up the hotel room with the analyst. So we'd have like three, four screens. We'd have balls and shields. I'd have one-on-ones with the guys where we do like very deep one-on-ones. Like if we were talking that time, I used to help with ball carriage as well. But we'd look at your clips. I put up your clips from every angle. Like we have screens on, big screens on. We say, okay, look at that carry, then look at your tackle. What's in common? Sorry, look at your carry and look at your tackle. What's in common with your body positions? Oh, always look like very upright and like non-explosive. Exactly. How are we going to fix that? We're going to fix it like this. And we'd literally right there. Like obviously not flat out, but like you're gonna do this. You see when you fend, you do that. Or when you hit with your shoulder, drop like this, keep your eyes on him like that. Mate, and we do 30, 40, 50 minute one-on-ones. And I do it till 1 o'clock in the morning. and you just, oh, and you wake up and you start again and go and go. You just work so intensively like that, and then boom, you know, a game's upon you, and then you review and you go again. It's like in the trenches of note. It's actually of note, and then it's over, and it's like, oh, tournament's over. What do I do now? That's the part I didn't like. That's how I went back to clubs.
Imagine,
Like,
yeah.
you're like, I don't want to be that free, mate. I want to
So you said you went back then, mate, didn't you? So was it Southern Kings you headed to?
Yes.
Yeah, and how was it there, mate? And
It was good because we went in the Currie Cup first division, which they'd never won before. So we won that unbeaten. And that was our preparation for Super Rugby. We got a late inclusion, no time to buy anyone. The players we got were the ones that were just left fourth, fifth choice in most places, or injured, and no one wanted to touch them because they had like historical necks, historical ACLs and stuff. We literally assembled a few weeks before the time, never seen each other before. And then we ended up being the most successful debut team in the history of Super Rugby. We won the same amount of games as Hurricanes and Highlanders did that year with a brand new team out of, from scratch.
how was that then? Is that like a blank canvas, or am I you're just able to go and input whatever you want to input and just see how it goes?
Well, we had to play a type of rugby that had to put you on the same page quickly, which was territory based and obviously defense and conditioning based. So we played the Western Force, who were in before us, in a debut game, and everyone said we're going to take 60, 70 points. I mean, you can probably find the articles like where they interviewed us, and surely you don't expect to win a game. Surely you can't with the squad you've got. Surely, surely. Mate, in Port Elizabeth, it's a hotbed of rugby in South Africa. We got 50,000 people debut game, 50,000. Imagine you're supposed to take 50 points and you win 21-10. Sergio Peterson was a child prodigy, high school prodigy, 14-year-old, so played 14 or 18-year-old, 17-year-old, who was like Olympic record, like time for 100 meters. We decided to give him a go at 18. He scored a double to win that game in front of 50,000 people, game berserk. It's one of my best memories of all time. You fathom it. You're supposed to get drilled and you win in front of 50,000 people who haven't had pro rugby there for 20 years. Because it just died there, and they had to be had to be resuscitated, and mate, it was incredible, incredible. And then
That's
we were
huge.
the little Indians who could. We just fought hard. We beat the Highlanders, went to the Brumbies and shocked them. We're just a band of brothers. Just went stuff it. No one gives us a chance to play as hard as we can. And we took some licks along the way. Took some hidings along the way. It's very gratifying.
And that's all part of the learning, Omar, isn't it? You take an hiding to give an hiding out, don't you? And
That's it. We had a promotion relegation game versus the Lions, which a lot of people did think they should include both of us because it's quite unfair. We assembled so late, we did so well, and then then it's just like down to who wins. We lost. We beat them there, which no one beats them there, and they beat us at home by 1 point. But sorry, by 2 points. By aggregate, we lost by 1 point. And one of the hardest days of our lives to accept that the journey was over in such a short time. But we lived a lifetime in that season. Honestly, beautiful.
doesn't reignite the passion for every week coaching rather than a 10-week coaching.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right. That's understandable, that mate. I don't think you get that in many other sports, do you? Like that feeling.
Nah. Man, I couldn't imagine. I mean, like rugby's got it all. It's got the emotional
Yeah.
side, got the physicality, the camaraderie. It's a great sport.
It is, mate. We're lucky, aren't we? So,
Yeah.
Edinburgh. How does what a place to go, and I imagine you lived there. What a place to go. So, why Edinburgh, and how was it?
So we got relegated out of the tournament. Alan Solomon said to me, "Look, I've been given the Edinburgh job. Do you want to come with?" Simple as. It was Project Fixer Up as well, which became like this trademark thing. It just this fluke. Like every place I'd gone to before as well was like, "Oh, we're struggling. Can you help? We're struggling. Can you help?" I'm not saying I'm a hero, but it just happened to be the spot in the journey, that sweet spot of, "Oh, we're struggling with this. Will you come in and top it up?" So he said, "Listen, Edinburgh, it's like quite a lot of old players are coming to the end of an era. They're not winning games. Same thing, work rate, intensity, physicality, blah, blah, blah. Munster gives them 50. This guy gives them 60. It was horrendous." So he said, "Would you come across?" I said, "Yes." Went across there. We got in late, but we did a good job there too. Very, very good job. And obviously, there's a lot of stories, but like the one story is I arrived the Wednesday. They were paying Munster in Cork, and Alan had only been there 2 weeks. So I hadn't coached them at all. We arrived there, took 50 from their second team with our best team, 50. Okay. Alan came into the change room and said, "We play these guys in 5 weeks' time in Champions Cup. I don't care what happens next, But mate, you will not take 50 like that again, and you'll see why. And he walks out, obviously a couple of profanities, which I won't do now on this call. And we took some extra time with the boys. We worked super hard, and the training sessions were hard, really hard. You had to get that level up, and it wasn't pleasant at times. But mate, we played at Murrayfield against Munster, and we brutalized them. I think we won 26-15. And then Paul O'Connell, Donica, Callaghan, the proper real deal team. And we beat them. And he said, that's what happens when you put the time in. And that was kind of the formula every time, wasn't it? It's like underdogs can't do a job, put the work in, do the job. That's the template. We had some good times, but
So, mate, done it. It works.
it works. It works. Yeah. And so that, yeah, the Edinburgh thing was a nice thing. I got divorced at that time, unfortunately, so which made it tough to stay on. I got divorced right when I arrived, out of the blue. It was a stone cold thing. We don't have to include in the story. I'm just telling you the background. So I got divorced as I arrived, and I had to stay on for 10 more games before I could go home to see what the hell happened. And then we went into the second year, and through basically towards the middle to end of the second year, or basically it was 7 games to go the second year, a lot was going on with my son and my daughter because they were still living in South Africa. It was just too much stress, so I had to go back, which is a pity because we could have done some great things if we continued on. But yeah, it is what it is. So, but it was a good experience.
That's some, sorry, mate. That's something fans don't understand and get, do they? They don't get that there's a life outside the rugby sometimes for you elite people, do they? They think you eat, sleep, breathe it, and everything else is hunky dory, and it just isn't.
No. When I got divorced, I mean, I didn't see it coming. It was on email. She was supposed to come to Scotland and just never pitched. And it's got an email going, divorce proceedings. So, you know, that's the price you pay in sport. You know, not to say I neglected family, but it does take a lot of your brain space. And it comes back to your first question is, do I find time to relax? Now I do, because, you know, shit goes down.
Like a harsh lesson, mate, but like at least you're at the better side of it now. So
Absolutely.
Leon and France comes along, mate, and how does that happen?
Yeah, so basically, I took a sabbatical from rugby. I thought to resolve this marriage thing and be there for my kids, but I realized I couldn't stay out of rugby. I wasn't going to be a marketing manager 9 to 5. So I got a call to go and help them. Unfortunately, it was not the right timing. I went to do a job that no one could have done it at that time, properly. You know, I added some value, but then I had to go. I think I sowed some seeds for the next time around when Mignoni and them came in, but the fact is, there's too much going on. They were too far gone. You needed to do a strong clear out. They did a medium clear out. Because normally, when you do a fixer up with 8 to 10 games to go, they put you in control and you do what you need to do. There's not like a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So that wasn't as smooth as I would have liked it. But another lesson learned on situational analysis. Don't just go for the sake of it in terms of it might, you know, do more homework before you arrive. It's a decent club, but the timing wasn't the greatest timing. So, yeah.
And so be it, mate, isn't it? It's that's how it can work sometimes. And so when you're in and out of them leagues, mate, how do you keep adapting? And that was a question I was going to ask later, but now we're at it. How do you keep adapting your methods because of the rule changes and the type of personnel that play in certain positions now and things like that?
I'm a thinker, mate. I think deeply about things, and I try and think about what is something in its essence, okay, and work back to improve it. So I'll check other sports, I'll check other leadership styles, I'll check other conditioning methods. I'll always think of hybrid cross-pollination methods, but I always think of what is something in its essence and work backwards from there. You know, so you, for example, the one analogy is if you look at an apple tree. You don't look at the apple. You don't look at the twig attached to the apple. You don't look at the branch. You don't even look at the trunk. What you look at is the soil. Now they're all interconnected, but in its essence, it's the soil and the seedling that make this tree. It's not the, you don't just look at the apple skin, the, you know, the twig that goes into the apple, then the branch. So first principles, what is something in its essence? And then go back and try and re-engineer. And that's what I try and do. Some of my stuff, I think, some stuff, like anything in life, some things are evergreen. The fact that you train to be functionally fit, you know, explosive, multiple high intensity efforts over time, at least three, or what we call triple collision efforts with ease. These things are the box standard ideologies. How you do get to that now is the change up. You know what I mean?
No, and I imagine you're kept on your toes a lot with certain rule changes and that, mate. But when did you start firing out that content that I've spoke to you about that I first seen? Because I didn't really, without being rude to your home, I didn't realize like where you were from, what you were doing. I seen these videos and I just never seen that type of range of movement and action before. So when did you get the content idea?
The content happened because of COVID. A lot of guys
Right.
reached out and just said, is there anything I can do that can do drills at home? And I started putting stuff out, started having webinars and master classes, built a website, started doing training videos, and it was a massive response. I couldn't believe it. My missus could not believe it. Some videos that I'd done on Instagram got 1 million views from like menial stuff in the beginning. I was like, what the hell? So I started to help coaches I started the videos because of helping coaches on during COVID, you know. And players who want the drills to do in their bedroom. So,
Yeah, no,
look.
because they are really good, and if people haven't seen them, go and look at them, isn't it? It's all on your Instagram and stuff, oh my, yeah.
Yeah, and I've got a link for a link tree to buy them, like more advanced ones. But yeah, that's how it came about.
Right, no, because like I said, I was just like, knowledge is power, isn't it? Until you've seen it and witnessed it or heard it, you don't ever know of it. So it was. I enjoyed it anyway. I still watch them now, and I'm not really involved in rugby anymore, but
I appreciate it.
it's a great outlet for someone to have a look at. And like you said, even if it's just a 1% that you can help change, they're such a different player, aren't they?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the kind words. It does. I believe it helps. So, you know, it's one of those things. You just you don't. I don't like to do things in a cliched way, like hold press, or you know, you have to jackal like this and you enter the line like that. I like to think differently, especially if you look at how attack attacks. Think for yourself. Like people always say, like what's they always look outwardly for the answer. First, struggle with the answer. Let it sit with you first. Watch games and think, wow, look at the trajectory of his line. Look how he catches the ball. Where are his hands when he catches the ball? Where's his hips? Where's his feet, foot placement? How do those guys run onto the ball? And just think about, all right, if I'm standing in front there, what would it look and feel like? What would I have to do to cut that off, to shut off that option, to get an intercept, to get a ball and all, or to make a good tackle? And sit with it and struggle with it. Don't look for the answer with someone else straight away. And you'll be surprised how far you can come thinking for yourself and then bounce it off someone and say, listen, you know, I was thinking on this type of shape, would you do this? And they go, oh, that's quite profound. Let me have a look. Oh, maybe not all the way, but maybe this. I think it's important to consider things and consider them strongly for yourself initially.
And you've probably got a lot of thought process due to your versatility when you were growing up and how the position changes as well. Because defending at 7 is completely different to defending at 12 and 13. But to be
Absolutely.
honest, so is 12 and 13, isn't it?
Yeah.
Completely different defensive mindset. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right, mate. And then the Sharks come back around and you head home, mate. How did that come to fruition?
I got a call from Gary Gold saying, I'm an emergency job again. Feel like we're not living up to our potential. They took a record amount of tries the year before. They'd lost a lot of Springboks, but still had a few decent amount of Springboks. And he was in one of those. We got the toughest draw in Super Rugby, which was five Kiwi sides, three away. And that time was Super 18. Not everyone had all the Kiwi sides, and we had all of them. And he said, mate, get across here. I need you. So I came home, and I knew if I could turn that around, because they really had a bad previous season, I could get something really big. And we did. We turned them around, mate. We were ferocious. Honestly, we had some great stock, some little known players, Andre Esterhazy, the Dupuy twins at that time, innocuous players that we turned, you know, that turned into great players. And obviously, that Springboks like Lwazi Mvovo, Odwan Dingane, you know, really class guys. Willie La Roux came in to join us that year. He had Beeston Tawerera, Kunyu Stason. So, quite a team. I was excited about it. And we actually played warm-up games against Toulouse and Toulon in the preseason that year. And we beat them both. And we saw what Andre and the Dupuy brothers were going to be, mate. Even then, they started to show their shoots off. Boom, boom, boom. Absolute killer. And we did great. We did great. Made the semi-finals, got knocked out there in very tough trouble back at the Hurricanes. We played the Hurricanes away. Horrendous, the worst conditions you've ever seen. Like literally, the ball would spiral like an alien took control of it. The ball wouldn't even hit the ground. It was at the cake tin in Wellington, mate. The weather was something like I've never seen till today. And we lost that game, but it was a great season. We were like unbeaten for quite some time. We beat three of the Kiwi sides. We beat the Highlanders in Dunedin. It was a great season, and we beat the Hurricanes, who were on fire. So in the play in the before the playoffs, so it was a
Yeah.
great time to be involved. Great players. Great to be back in South Africa coaching Saffas too.
So why do you think so many South Africans come to Europe and really excel? Like them names you meant, even Coney done really well at Sale. The Dupree twins ripping it up at Sale. Andre's ripped it up at probably changed how inside centres are looked at in England, hasn't he? Because of the
Yeah.
way he can do things. Why do you think people do so well?
It's a hard thing. It's a mixture of things. I think they're very studious. They give 120% without being asked, and naturally very talented. And rugby is a way of expressing your honor where we come from. You know, you say you're going to come across and give your best, you're going to get the best of them at 120%. And they're specimens. I mean, for us, everything's about the gain line. Are you willing to go to war and die on the gain line? And they are. So that's probably why they succeed. They just put it all on the line. They don't hold back. They do not hold
Yeah.
back.
But no disrespect to like Aka, but probably people didn't really know who Aka van der Merwe was before he come.
Yeah.
He made a hell of a name for himself, didn't he? He done really well at Sale, yeah.
Dynamite.
Yeah. Right, and then Worcester, mate. So talk to us about Worcester and how they convinced you to come back to England.
Well, I got a call from Stud to go across to help them because they were nearly relegated. Help them. And while I was
Yeah.
helping them, Worcester said, "We're going to be relegated. Can you help with, I think, 8 games to go?" And Ed Griffiths to meet me in a coffee shop. We joked there was the onion soup incident where over onion soup, he coerced me to get across there. And yeah, they did. I did, he did really well to convince me to go across, convince me the Premiership's the place to be, all the money's going to be there. And all the stars are going to be there. So we went across, made an arrangement to get there, and we kept the club up for numerous seasons. And we went from, struggling to stay in the Prem to doing well. We did really well. Some great seasons where we finished 7th or 8th, I think it was. And I think when I got there, they conceded like something like 104 tries in one season. It was like mad. And we got some
Yeah.
respect back, got them to the top six in terms of defense and things like that. It was a gratifying job. Good job. And I
Yeah.
loved the Prem, so I was happy to be there.
And that's when the club started getting recognised with players being picked internationally as well, wasn't it? And attracting some good names, yeah.
Yeah, same
So,
template, work rate, etc.
yeah, how was it going to from Stade to there? Is because it's completely again, I know it might be repeating myself, mate. I apologise, but
No.
the league, the way it's played, the game is completely different, isn't it? Like the
Yeah.
French don't play like they do in Europe in a league game, do they?
No, they don't. That's quite true. So Gonzalo Casado, who's now head coach of Italy, it's no surprise he's done so well there. Highly rated, great coach, similar in the Rossi mode, good emotional intelligence, highly technical. So I coached with him there and he did a great job. He had won the top 14 2 years previously, but they went through a bit of a slump and they brought me in to sort of help. Fantastic coach. And I'd say, yes, the thing with top 14, because the preseason's so short, they play themselves fit. They don't arrive with this big preseason where it's a million miles an hour, high ball in play, blah, blah, blah. It's actually low ball in play, easy, easy catch a monkey. And they get to around 10, 12, 13. Then they start to go like that. So their games can be quite slow against each other initially for quite a few rounds until they, hit their straps. Sorry. And then they become dynamite. And then as you see, they're going to Champions Cup and they're just, from perceiving to be lumpy and slower to they can take control of any team they want, actually. And the Prem teams, at times, if you're not careful, you can get crushed by these guys.
They probably take Europe a bit more serious, mate, don't they? Or it comes across like they do than they do domestic games.
You're right. I think what happens is they start to look at the English teams, go, wow, these guys are organized, they fit, they're fast, high ball in play, we better match that. And then they up their game. They've got a lot of internationals in their teams as well. So when they decide, it is what it is, they just do what they got to do.
How was the Pumas, mate? And how did that come round?
Pumas was fantastic. That was also just between the sabbatical and Leon. That was a fantastic opportunity because a guy I'd coached was head coach MJ Mintz, and they were in the Currie Cup First Division and Vodacom Cup, and they were losing games. They had quite a good squad. Faf was there. I coached Faf there, and sorry, my missus. Oh, sorry, my missus just asked me a question.
All right, mate.
No, it's all good. And So long story short is I went in as high performance director to turn the whole thing around, sort out the periodization, their training week, what they did in general, because I had a lot of experience, obviously, attack, defense, kicking game, bringing it together. And we actually won 4 games on the road traveling. We won the Vodacom Cup, beating Western Province in front of a full house with them. Currie Cup, we did very well, 1 point away from a semi-final, but we beat Lions, Bulls, Western Province again. We're tough, we're nuggety, we're organized. It was really nice experience being in charge. And I had a similar role when I was with the Kings initially. It was quite similar, in the sense that Alan Solomons relied on me to bring in outside of knowledge to the Kings and say, all right, how would you run the conditioning? How would you run a coaching session? How should we play to win? So I actually had a very senior stroke, like I'd say mini head coach role in that sense twice. And I actually really enjoyed it. And I think it's something obviously for the future that I keep my eye on.
Right, no, I like that, mate. I like that. So, Bristol, why Bristol? And
Bristol, I think, I'd run my course at Worcester, we'd done well, we set up, we hit a ceiling, and then I heard that Pat was looking for somebody. My name was put forward. They said, oh, he's apparently he's on second or third round interviews already. We said, well, just ask. And then he heard I was available and he was really interested. He said, well, I'd love to speak to Omar, give me his number. He called me, said, can we do a Zoom tomorrow? Had a Zoom, had a great Zoom over 2, 3 hours, actually. And he gave me the job virtually that week. And I wanted to go to Bristol because up and coming team, Pat was known as a highly technical coach, great attack. And I wanted to challenge myself in an environment where they went all out attack, willing to fucking take you by the throat and just crush you with tries, but you needed a great defense behind that. So at that time, the defense was like 9th or 10th in the league, dominant shots, I never had them. And it was a chance to get stuck in there and put that template under a great playing team. And it worked. It was unreal. Loved my time under Pat in that time. I learned a lot about how to run attack from scratch, his leadership styles and how he ran his program was quite fascinating at the time. Obviously, we moved into the £10 million training facility, which was next level. And we had a great run in. We started with winning obviously Challenge Cup against Toulon. We beat Toulon, we beat Bordeaux. Went top of the log for virtually the entire season the next year in the Premiership. Made two semi-finals. Unfortunately, both semi-finals we lost, including that massive what they call Bristol Gate game
Yeah.
against Quins in triple overtime. One of the craziest games of all time. Good times
Yes.
though. Good, some good times in there.
Yeah. And that's a good point now. So how do you convert the energy from an out and out attacking team that know if you score 40, we'll score 45, to being able to say, well, no, you'll score maybe 10, but we'll still score 45.
Yeah,
How do you shift that mentality, mate?
we shifted it because Pat was supportive of that, and he gave me a specific designation. It's like, I want guys in front of guys. If we lose the ball, transition defense has to be great. And that's what we worked. We trained, we played pace, lose the ball, boom, we're up, we're in shape. And we trained to be super fit in front of the ball as quick as possible all the time. And then when we hit very hard. We used to hit guys bloody, the guys could tackle. And because it came from him, it was amazing. It was full buy-in. We'll play you off your feet, but mate, when we lose the ball, that's the insurance policy. All hands to the pump, hold people out. It was incredible. I think when we finished off that season that we were number one, I think we only conceded 40 tries in the entire league season with a full roster of teams, which I think was close to the record least with, I think it was Sale Saris were joined with us at that time. Very low amount of tries. And we scored
Yeah.
max points in every game, virtually. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It was a good
No,
time.
it is, mate. That's some doing, isn't it? That's like dedication to both sides of the ball, isn't it?
Yeah, it
Yeah.
was. Exactly, it
Yeah.
was.
And Exeter, mate, that's where you're currently at. And why Exeter? And how are you enjoying it there?
Why Exeter is just Rob Baxter straight off the bat. Backy always being around the circuit, you knew he's a top bloke. You knew he was doing something special there. You always had an aura of like salt of the earth, gets on with it. Trustworthy, strong man. I loved how they were. They were like just run, gun, get it done, tough team. And when that chance came about to get in front of him, got in front of him as quick as I could. And fortunately, he liked me. Fortunately, he liked me. And he said I was crazy because I was jumping up and demoing stuff. And he was like, crazy guy. Who's this crazy guy? But apparently, he liked that about me, which is nice. And I felt the same ever since. It's going on 2 years now. Shortly, it'll be 2 years. I felt that, obviously I came in at a different time when they were transitioning a lot of the old bucks out, which, it was challenging but exciting. Got to work with the last crop of the top players they ever had, which Nolsey and the boys, which is fantastic. But I think we hit the semi-final against La Rochelle, but a lot of guys were already announced leaving. And it was a great time to be involved with the club and sad because I'd coached against those guys for nearly 8, 9 years, and I was dying to be on their side and they were moving out, which was strange. But now we're on the rebuild with the Young Bucks in the second year. I think we've done some very good things. You can't get everything done in 1 year. I think we've done some very good things. A lot of players have developed. We've come a far way. But you know, the season's not over yet, but we've done well so far, and I've really loved my time here. You know, I really have.
Brilliant, mate. So, again, transitioning and getting people to fine-tune things. Exeter players brand the rugby, mate, that teams couldn't cope with.
Yeah.
The pick and drive and the expansiveness with Sladey and stuff. So how is it going into that type of environment? Is that you still buzzing again to get in there and just enhance it?
Absolutely. I mean, because what they believe in was just get on with it, be, you know, do whatever it takes, train out of your skin, play out of your skin. That's what I'm about. So I think we had natural alignment, natural fit. Yeah.
Sounds it, mate, definitely. So got a few tough questions for you, if that's all right, mate.
Well, no problem. So, I'm going to move so the kids, if you need to come in, yeah? Yeah, I'm going to move upstairs so you know I can just
no worries, off. Mate. Yeah, yeah.
And talk to me as you go because they're going to finish their dinner.
No worries. So, any pre-match superstitions, mate?
My pre-match superstition is not to post or do any social media or answer any questions about the game to anybody.
Right. And is that something you've done since COVID? That.
Yeah. Since COVID, I generally like if somebody asks for an interview or there's something to be done at the ground, which to post something about the ground or what's going on with the game. I don't like to do it. I feel something will go wrong.
That's fair enough. So the toughest player you've coached, definition of that word, very different for everybody.
Yeah. So when you mean toughest in a good way or belligerent?
either or, mate.
Toughest player. Marcel Coutier was a monster. But Jean-Luc Dupriez was up there, but Marcel Coutier, who is playing at Bulls at the moment, was Ulster and Sharks. Mate, that is a killer, like proper. But Jean-Luc Dupriez, him and Andre Ester, it's hard because there's been some monsters in there, mate, like monsters. I'd say Jean-Luc and Marcel, monsters, dude.
So the favorite, your favorite away ground that you've coached at?
International or club?
Either or again, mate.
Such a tough one. It's like so many grounds have got different vibes and meanings when you know what I mean? I would say international, I really like Murrayfield. Even though the Millennium is really next level, I've got a soft spot for Murrayfield. Maybe it's because my Six Nations, the first Six Nations there, when it's packed and the lighters are on, they sing Flowers of Scotland. There's something, I do love it. I would say that's probably number one.
And do you like the older stadia or the newer stuff?
I prefer probably older stadiums, the golden oldies. Like Newlands back in the day, obviously you couldn't, you know, all the games were 50,000 people sold out for club games back in the day. So yeah. I'd say those two really, I'm unreal, really.
Yeah. Right, mate. So if you could go back and tell a younger Omar something, what would it be?
Be more patient. Be more patient. It's not just about not win at all costs, but there's a time where you can take a breath, things will work out. You don't have to go above and beyond 1,000,000% every second of the day, every minute of the day. Things will sometimes work out without you having to do too much. That's what I would say. Yeah.
I like that, mate.
Don't always do too much. It will work out. Yeah. Have trust that things work out. Sometimes you say, taking a breath now, I'm stepping back, it's going to work out. Not do more. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like it, mate.
Follow, like, share, subscribe, and endorse us via Facebook, Trot the Eggin, Twitter, @TrotTheEggin/@JohnHeath, Instagram, @Trot_D_Egg_in, YouTube, Trot the Eggin, LinkedIn, John Hetherington, and Spotify, Trot the Eggin. You've been listening to Trot the Eggin. Thanks to our sponsors, Bardell Sports. Follow us on Twitter @TrotTheEggin and Instagram @Trot_The_Egg_in.